From Arizona to North Carolina, Kansas to Maine, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the estate or death tax has caused the demise of many small businesses and farms. But some in Congress are proposing to double down on the tax. Phil Kirpin from American Commitment is here to explain. Republican Glenn Youngkin scored a major upset in the Virginia gubernatorial election. What does it mean for the Democrats' big spending agenda in Washington? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. That so-called Build Back Better plan now includes a massive tax cut for the wealthiest 5% of Americans. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details. And President Joe Biden has joined many world leaders in calling for a global minimum tax. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary on why this will harm economic competitiveness. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. After paying taxes all of your life, government takes even more of your money when you die via estate taxes. As they look for more revenue sources, Democrats in Congress are proposing to add to that tax. Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment. He has details for us. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, tell us a bit about the death tax, the history of it, and where do we currently stand before we begin talking about the proposal to actually expand it?
The current federal estate tax, we've had other ones previous to that that were repealed, but the current federal estate tax dates to World War I, a war that's been over now for some time, and it was to pay for the war effort originally in World War I, and it was originally pretty narrow, as these taxes often are, and then it was expanded pretty dramatically over time in a variety of ways, and then it probably reached its greatest and most destructive reach by the 90s. It was, I think, 55% of everything over $600,000 the federal government took. A pretty egregious tax, and that was one of the issues that President Bush, W. Bush, campaigned on, was that he was going to repeal it. You know, he scored a lot of political points with that, and in fact, he called for full repeal in the Bush tax cuts in 2001, and they were able to repeal it, but only for 1 year. It was repealed just for 1 year in 2009, and because they were a couple of votes short of being able to overcome a Democratic filibuster to make that a permanent repeal, it snapped back to life in 2010. And it snapped back to life with a $1 million exemption and a 55% rate, so almost the same as it was before that. But there were some big fights right around that time in Congress, and they were basically able to, over a couple of skirmishes over a number of years, over the last decade or so, we ended up where it is now, which is it's a 40% tax, but the exemption amount has been raised three or four times, and it's currently about $12 million. So President Trump, who always likes to exaggerate these things, he went out on the campaign trail and said, I repealed the death tax, it's gone, there's no more death tax. And then when he got pressed on it, he said, well, I meant, you know, for the people in my crowd who all are going to have less than $12 million when they die. So he overstated the progress that he made on it, as he was prone to do, but presently it's a 40% tax on estates above $12 million, which means very few estates now pay it directly, you know, because the exemption amount's been raised so dramatically. And by the way, Democrats fought every step of the way against every increase in that exemption amount, and now they say, oh, it only hits the super rich. And it's like, well, yeah, no thanks to you. But that's where we are on that currently, although, of course, I'd point out that $12 million plus means it still can be devastating for the most successful family farms and businesses, the kinds of employers that can anchor a town. And you still have this problem where when it hits, sort of ongoing concerns, businesses have to liquidate or be acquired or, you know, somehow come up with an awful lot of cash that they can't because their assets, you know, exist in the values in the land or in the equipment and so forth. And so it's still a problem. It still exists, but it's a problem now for only the largest, most successful family farms and businesses. And I'll leave it there unless you have another question about what the current state of the tax is.
Well, what I want to take a look at now, Phil, of course, congressional Democrats are casting about for any and every way to increase revenue because they have historically massive spending proposals on the table. And essentially what they're looking at is a double death tax. What are they proposing there?
Well, the Biden proposal, which is not in his most recent framework, so maybe we've defeated this, but these things keep changing so rapidly that I'm not going to chalk it up as a win until this whole thing is over and these people are out of office. But the Biden proposal on this was to say that we're going to apply a capital gains tax at death, which is to say death would become a realization event for capital gains purposes. So even though you haven't sold any assets, you haven't sold the farm, you haven't sold the manufacturing plant, you haven't sold whatever the assets might be, the IRS would say, look, we think all of the assets of the person who just died are worth X amount. The original acquisition price decades and decades ago was this much, much smaller amount. You now owe capital gains tax on the difference. And, of course, there's no inflation adjustment in capital gains tax. And Biden also wanted to significantly raise the rate of the capital gains tax. So you would owe a capital gains tax essentially on the increase in value of all of the assets. And the exemption amount that he proposed was just $1 million. And so we'd be going back to that much, much lower exemption amount. So you're not even just talking about businesses at that point. You know, in a lot of housing markets in this country, just the home could be over $1 million in capital gain if you bought it in the 70s for $10,000, and now it's worth over $1 million, and not to mention all the other assets. And so this really broadens the reach of taxes at death. And, you know, I referred to it as a double death tax, Loam, because this was not instead of the federal estate tax. If it were instead of, maybe we'd consider it, but this was in addition to it. And so if you had a larger estate, a large family farm business that's over that $12 million, you'd pay this capital gains tax at death, and then you'd also have the estate tax as well.
The Committee to Unleash Prosperity has commissioned some modeling on this proposal and on the death tax and its impact on businesses, the potential job loss. Tell us a little bit about what that modeling found.
Well, this was a very conventional model, not a supply side model. It was a modeling firm that does a lot of work for governments and very mainstream sort of assumptions. And the result was about 1 million jobs lost from this tax, and there are some state breakouts as well. So, in Pennsylvania, I think the job loss was about 20,000 or 30,000 jobs, and the lost income impact is an average of about $8,000 to $10,000 per household in lost income as a consequence of this. Now, that's not just the households that are directly hit by this tax; that's the economic effect broadly. So, that's the average across the entire economy.
In addition to the impact on business, all of this, I would assume, downstream going to have an impact on consumers as well?
Clearly, anything that has a negative economic effect is going to affect everyone. It has an effect on the whole economy. You have less productivity. You're going to have less economic growth. That means that you've got lost income on the household level. And so that average of 8,000 to 10,000 that I mentioned, you know, it's going to affect some more than others. But generally speaking, you're going to have a negative economic consequence for everyone.
We have been talking with Phil Kirpin. Phil is president of American Commitment. We've been talking about the so-called death tax and a proposal that's still floating around, maybe not quite over the finish line, but still potentially floating around in Washington to really add to that death tax. Phil, if we have listeners who would like to learn more about this issue, learn more about American Commitment, where can they go to get that? And tell us a bit about American Commitment.
We're a national free market advocacy group. We work really on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues. And if people are interested in this issue or any of the other things we're working on, the website is americancommitment.org.
Phil Kirpin from American Commitment joins us periodically here on American Radio Journal. Phil, thank you for being back with us.
All right. Have a good one.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth looks at both politics and policy. They're all intersecting, especially in the wake of the big upset election in Virginia this past week. Scott, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me back, Loman. It's great to be back.
In the Commonwealth of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin, big upset in what was really a blue state. Talk a little bit about the results in Virginia. Also, New Jersey, which ended up being razor close. Almost nobody saw that coming. What occurred here on Election Day?
I think there were a lot of Republicans that were quietly optimistic in Virginia heading into the election this week. Glenn Youngkin had all the momentum. Terry McAuliffe had a bunch of unforced errors, especially related to education. On election eve, he had Randy Weingartner out there campaigning with him. And if you think bringing in the teachers union boss to help really motivate voters to come out in your election is a wise move, I think that in retrospect, he's probably regretting that one. But the bottom line is Democrats in Washington are now scrambling as they try to unpack exactly what happened in this important election in Virginia. In New Jersey, obviously, expectations were exceeded. Republicans did well on the down ballot and at the top of the ticket. Incredibly close election there with Ciattarelli slightly losing to Governor Murphy, the incumbent. And so as Democrats here in Washington look at what's going on in these elections this week, some of them are doubling down.
Let's talk for a minute or two, Scott, about the issues that were prevalent in the Virginia gubernatorial election. It wasn't really Build Back Better so much as it was education and more state and local related issues, correct?
So what I think happened here in the Virginia elections was really a mandate for Glenn Youngkin and his positions on parental inclusion and education contrasted with Terry McAuliffe's. You have a big, big issue here in Loudoun County, Virginia, that's resonated throughout the entire country in relation to school safety. And then you've also got what's going on in Washington, D.C., that's affecting every American in the hidden tax of inflation. Inflation's a real thing right now. I filled up gasoline this week, and for the first time in a real long time, it was over $50. We also have wokeism fatigue and critical race theory issues. You've got a culture war that's brewing among fed-up Americans that possibly wanted to turn the page on Donald Trump, but I think Terry McAuliffe's last-minute scramble to try to put up negative ads against Glenn Youngkin being tied to Donald Trump and what happened on January 6th was a fool's errand. I think that Virginians are tired of hearing about vaccine mandates. We do have sort of a posture of don't tread on me in Virginia. And what that means is that we want individual freedoms and liberties to be respected and protected by our government. And Democrats have obviously totally trampled on those rights. I think that this has a lot of similarities between the 2009 election. You had Barack Obama coming in and sort of overplaying his hand with a big government approach on financial services reforms through Dodd-Frank. And then you also had, obviously, him pushing through Obamacare in 2009, which ultimately became law in 2010. And if you remember, in 2009, Republicans won in Virginia, and Republicans won in New Jersey with Chris Christie. And so all across the country right now, I think there are Democrats serving in Congress that are starting to wonder, am I really listening to the people that I represent? Am I understanding what issues are percolating within the district, or am I willing to walk the plank for Nancy Pelosi and a clueless Joe Biden?
Speaking of Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden, the message was sent very loud, very clear by voters in Virginia and New Jersey and in a lot of other races around the country. We don't really have time to get into all of those, but has the message been received by the leadership in Congress, the Democratic leadership in Congress, as they look again at this infrastructure bill, a $3.5 trillion proposed Build Back Better bill? Did they get the message that these are not the things the American people want?
I sure hope so, but I think that the Democrats are stubborn people. I think that they're willing to walk the plank for Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi, and I think that they're going to double down on this effort to pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill and to try to get some sort of a victory on the so-called Build Back Better plan that Joe Biden has been trying to champion. Now, we know that we have a complicit media in terms of their relationship with Joe Biden. I haven't heard anybody in the media really challenge Joe Biden on what is included and what's not included in the Build Back Better plan. Obviously, we've had various iterations of that legislation floating around. And this week, Nancy Pelosi changed her mind and decided that, you know what, we really should have those paid leave mandates included in the Build Back Better plan. And so once again, they're moving the football back and forth. Maybe you have a 5-yard penalty followed by a 5-yard completion and a 3-yard run. But I don't think the Democrats are anywhere close to scoring a touchdown on this legislation. The bottom line is, whenever the House passes it, you're going to have reconciliation going through the Senate, and through the Senate's arcane rules, it's going to dramatically change the underlying legislation when it comes to what will be included and what will be stripped out of the legislation. We get into the weeds here in Washington, obviously, and it's a little bit difficult to understand, even for people like me, exactly why the Senate parliamentarian will allow various provisions to be included and others not to be.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., and we're united in this idea of economic freedom and liberty. And if you want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. You can actually sign up to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thanks again for being here.
Thank you.
The cap on state and local tax deductions could be eliminated under the Build Back Better plan, and it is a massive tax break for the wealthiest of Americans. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports.
President Joe Biden's Build Back Better plan was pitched as a once-in-a-generation rebalancing of America's socioeconomic scales. Democrats were going to tax the rich, they said, and the proceeds of those taxes were going to be used to fund a massive expansion of government benefits for everyone else. But now it appears that that Build Back Better plan is going to deliver an overall tax cut for America's wealthiest citizens. Yes, a tax break for the rich could end up being actually the largest part of Biden's Tax the Rich plan. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a closer look at Democratic plans unveiled on Tuesday to repeal something known as the SALT deduction. That's the state and local tax deduction. And that deduction on your federal taxes has been capped since 2017, but Democrats in the House at least say that they plan to remove that cap for the next 5 years as part of this massive social spending plan that Congress and the White House continue to negotiate. Now, it's a little bit complicated, so just bear with me here for a second. The SALT deduction cap refers to the policy that was put in place in 2017 as part of the Trump tax reform that capped the amount of money that Americans are allowed to deduct off of their federal taxes if they pay that amount in state and local tax payments. So you're allowed to deduct $10,000 in state and local tax payments from your federal taxes. And that cap is high enough at $10,000 that it covers the vast majority of Americans. But the changes made in 2017 meant that wealthier Americans, Americans who pay more than $10,000 in state and local taxes, could no longer take advantage of the full value of that deduction, and they could no longer take advantage of what is effectively a backdoor subsidy that eases the burden of living in high-tax states and localities. Unsurprisingly, restoring that deduction, or at least raising the cap, has been a priority for lawmakers from California, New Jersey, New York, and other high-tax states, and now it appears they will get their way. But there's no way around this. Removing the SALT cap is a huge tax break for a very small number of very wealthy Americans. It's not just unprogressive, it's really anti-progressive. It goes against everything else that Democrats say they want to do with the tax code. According to the Tax Policy Center, only about 9% of American households would see any benefit at all from repealing the SALT cap, and the wealthiest 1% of American households would receive 56% of the benefits. Including the SALT cap repeal in Biden's revised Build Better framework would transform the overall package into a $30 billion net tax cut for the wealthiest 5% of Americans next year, according to an analysis from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. That group says that the 5-year repeal would cost about $475 billion, with $400 billion of that tax cut going to the top 5% of households, and the ultimate cost, if you will, and lost revenue of that proposed tax cut would end up being larger than any other part of Biden's proposal, larger than the child tax credit, larger than spending on childcare and pre-K, larger than the climate-related tax credits, and larger than the expanded healthcare funding included in the bill. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with cutting taxes, of course, and the wealthy already pay a disproportionately large share to the federal government. But the SALT deduction is problematic for a few reasons, not least of which because how much you pay to your state government should not affect how much you owe the federal government. Wealthy residents of California or New York who want to pay less in taxes should move to a lower tax state or vote for politicians who will cut taxes, not have their tax bills subsidized by residents of other lower tax states. The SALT deduction is also bad policy because it effectively serves as a subsidy for state governments that impose high taxes, because residents of those states do not have to bear the full burden of their state and federal taxes, then politicians in those places are insulated against the political costs of approving expensive and often wasteful projects, and they can raise taxes without that burden falling fully on their own constituents. And abolishing the SALT deduction has been, for years, part of bipartisan plans to overhaul the federal tax and spending codes. It's basically universally agreed that this is a bad tax break that disproportionately benefits just a very small group of Americans. The last thing we should be doing is giving more tax breaks to the very rich, Senator Bernie Sanders tweeted on Tuesday. He continued, Democrats campaigned and won on an agenda that demands that the very wealthy finally pay their fair share, not one that gives them more tax breaks. And I don't say this often, but hey, Senator Sanders has a good point. There's really no reason to give a targeted tax break to rich people. Of course, tax cuts, broad-based tax cuts, ones that benefit all Americans, consumers, and businesses alike, are certainly welcome, but this sort of targeted tax break really doesn't make any sense, especially when you look at the size of the federal deficit and the direction that it is moving. Now, given the haphazard negotiations between Congress and the White House in recent weeks over this bill, there's really no saying what could come next. Advocates of the SALT cap repeal seem fairly confident that they will get their way, but progressives or the White House could still force a change in direction. By the end of the week, who knows? This could be off the table all over again. After all, progressives in the House of Representatives have already had to swallow the removal of a politically popular paid leave program from Biden's agenda on the grounds that it was too expensive. That paid leave program would have cost an estimated $540 billion over 10 years, while the SALT cap repeal will cost about $475 billion over just 5 years. A few days after the paid leave proposal was discarded, Democrats are now promising to shovel big bucks into the bank accounts of some of the wealthiest people in America and force everyone else to make up the difference. Seems like that progressive takeover of Congress that we've heard so much about isn't really going according to plan. For more coverage of everything happening in Congress and around the rest of the country, including some fascinating election results this week, head on over to Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
A proposed global minimum tax on businesses would harm economic competitiveness and could also have an impact on state tax policies. So says Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal commentary.
President Joe Biden was recently in Rome for the G20 summit to discuss, among other things, the idea of setting a global minimum tax rate of 15%. At the summit, world leaders reportedly reached a deal to endorse this tax scheme and reported that 140 nations are currently in negotiations to implement a global minimum tax, with 136 nations signing on to the agreement by October. Here in the United States, the proposal has already been endorsed by President Joe Biden and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, and is part of recent policy debates in Washington, D.C. around taxing and spending. The idea behind a global tax is that there would be no country where corporations could relocate in order to avoid a minimum 15% corporate income tax rate. They're intended to eliminate tax havens In practice, a global minimum tax would eliminate vital competition between countries with disastrous economic results. Much of the discussion is pointed towards the idea that businesses need to pay their fair share. An important side note here, though, is that businesses do not pay taxes. People pay taxes at the end of the day. This might cause some to scratch their heads, but let me briefly explain. Businesses pass on the cost of tax burdens. Yes, while they legally pay the tax bill to the IRS or other state tax agencies, at the end of the day, it's all of us as people who pay the taxes, whether it's higher costs of goods or services, or perhaps in the case of workers, lower salaries or wages, or if you have a pension plan, if you are a teacher, a firefighter, a police officer, fewer earnings potential on your investment accounts and your pensions going forward. That's how people pay taxes, and businesses don't pay taxes at the end of the day. The ramifications of a global minimum tax could especially be disastrous for countries such as Ireland and Hungary, who currently have corporate tax rates under the proposed 15%, or for that matter, any nation that would want to seek to become more economically competitive in the future by setting rates under 15%. Ireland, for example, has been a huge net beneficiary of tax competition because of its low business taxes, and that what it has predictably led to more business activity for the nation. The best evidence of how this proposal will be disastrous can be seen by looking at the competition among the 50 states. The U.S. model of competitive federalism allows for states to implement, or in a few cases, not implement their own income taxes. Letting states establish their own tax rates and fiscal policies, state leaders are able to determine what's best for their own state economies, of course. In many cases, competition with neighboring states forces leaders to implement policies to increase their own economic competitiveness and growth. Now, following the idea of a global minimum tax and the attack on tax competition, it's not all that far-fetched to imagine some here in the United States bringing forth very similar arguments that businesses need to pay their fair share and shouldn't be able to shift their operations from high-tax states to low-tax states. That one-size-fits-all minimum tax rate for businesses here in the U.S. would be disastrous for economic growth and the idea of state autonomy. States would immediately lose the incentive to develop more competitive tax structures. Would we tell the 9 states that do without a personal income tax, some of America's leading growth states like Texas and Florida and Tennessee, that they must create an income tax in that scenario? The arguments for centrally planned tax structures fail at every turn. We've now seen how competitive taxation can be key to developing a thriving economy. Take Florida and New York, for example, which rank 2nd and 50th, respectively, in the latest Rich States, Poor States, Alec Laffer State Economic Competitiveness Index. The Sunshine State has never had a personal income tax, and it ranks among the top 15 for having the lowest corporate income taxes in America. And it's no surprise that Florida has been one of the fastest growing states in the United States over the past decades, getting millions of new residents, many of those residents coming from states with some of the highest tax rates like New York and California. Clearly, tax competition is an essential policy principle, whether it's at the state, federal, or even global level. It provides individuals and businesses with the ability to decide for themselves the type of government that works best for them. Just as states should continue to strive to build competitive tax structures that encourage economic growth and empower taxpayers, so too, nations should have the ability to strive to build those same competitive tax structures. Instead of setting a minimum global tax rate, world leaders should be more focused on crafting tax policies that benefit individuals and employers. The proposed global minimum tax would eliminate a key ingredient to economic health long term, that is, the idea of competition. For more information on this and more, please visit alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KCLC in St. Charles, Missouri, along with WFAY AM and FM in Fayetteville, North Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.